Well, let's jump in. We're going to look at our final message in our study of the book of John. It's our 16th message in our study. Today, that, of course, is the last chapter, John chapter 21, and we're going to be in verses 15 through 25. Now, saying that, let's kind of step back a little bit, do a little bit of a summary, if you will. And what we said last week was, as you read through the Gospel of John, you get to the closing of chapter 20, and it seems like that's good enough. Like, John has it all buttoned up right there, nice and neat, and Jesus has appeared to them. He's kind of given them some marching orders, and it would just end there, but it doesn't, and we have chapter 21. And what we said last week was that chapter 21 is really just an epilogue, right? It's that movie clip that comes after the credits roll to kind of give you an idea, a taste of what's coming next, the next movie or whatever, and that's exactly what John chapter 20 sets up, is what is going to take place in the book of Acts as we read on. And so with that said, you remember last week, Jesus had appeared to Peter, to Thomas, to the disciples, and Peter then, after that, literally gives up because of his failures, because of everything else. He goes back to where he was comfortable, back to his safe place, if you will. Peter went fishing, and the other disciples followed along with him. And it was there. They'd been fishing all night long. They had caught absolutely nothing. And all of a sudden, there's a man on the bank by a fire. That man calls out to them, "Hey, you guys catch anything?" "No, we hadn't caught anything." "Try the other side of the boat. Put your nets down on the right side." They do just that. They lower the net. And for a group of professional fishermen that have caught nothing all night, immediately the net is completely filled. They hoist it up. And the Bible tells us there were 153 fish in that net. And church, you remember what we said? You remember the importance of the number 153 is what? Yeah, we have no idea, right? We don't know why it's there, right? Except we know this, that it just points to the validity of Scripture, that it was written by men. Here we have this fisherman, and that's what fishermen do, that they count their catch, right? And John's putting that in. He said, "Hey, not only was it a big catch, 153, right?" He's like, "I want you to know how many there were there." Well, upon seeing that, upon getting that net up, they realize, man, that's Jesus over there. Jesus is the one that told us to lower our net. Jesus is the one that gave us this catch. Peter then takes his outer garment, wraps it around him, dives headfirst into the cold morning water, swims 100 yards to the shore just to be with Jesus. And that's where we pick up today. John then closes his gospel out, this portrait, if you will, that he's been painting of us, of who Jesus is, with a gospel presentation, a gospel invitation. That's what we're going to see in these 11 verses today. And so let's look then. We're going to look at verses 15 through 25, but I really want us to back all the way up to 12 where we ended last week. So let me read for us there, beginning in verse 12. "Come and have breakfast," Jesus told them. None of his disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took bread, and gave it to them. He did the same with the fish. Now, let me pause for just a moment. I know right now you're thinking, breakfast, right? Like, nobody here got up this morning and made salmon patties, right? It's just that's a little bit odd. But not odd in that day, right? That would not be uncommon for them at all to have fish and bread roasted over a fire. Matter of fact, that would be a great and hearty breakfast for them. Verse 15, when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said to him. "You know that I love you." "Feed my lambs," he told him. A second time he asked him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord," he said to him. "You know that I love you." "Shepherd my sheep," he told him. He asked him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved that he asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Feed my sheep," Jesus said. And I want you to see this morning, this is Jesus begins this invitation of redemption to Peter. Remember we said that's what all that chapter 21 was about, was the redemption of Peter and all that God was going to do through him, as we're going to see in the book of Acts. But here we have this invitation that I believe we all need to understand, because I think it pertains to all of us in the room today. And the first thing I want us to see is this. Did you notice how he called him Simon and not Peter? If you look back, it was John. John is the black letters. That's what John is saying. Jesus is red, right? John said Simon Peter, but Jesus said Simon, son of John. Simon, son of John. Simon, son of John, do you love me? He calls him Simon, and yet throughout Scripture, he had referred to him as Peter. You may remember all the way back in one of our early messages in John chapter 1 and verse 42, when Jesus first met the disciples, right? And Simon came to him, and Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Kephas or Cephas, which when translated is Peter." Do you remember that? And what we learn from that is in biblical times when they would name a child, a baby, and in particular the male of a family, the name would always have meaning behind it. It's not like today where we just grab, and there's some crazy names out. We looked at those several weeks ago, right? But it would always have some kind of meaning to it. And the name Simon meant to hear from God, to hear from God. But Jesus meets this guy, this fisherman, Simon, and he says, "Now, I know your parents have called you Simon, which means to hear from God, but I've got a new name for you, and it's Peter or Kephas, or you may see Petros in the Greek." Jesus told him this, "Listen, you're going to be a new creation in me. I have a new plan for your life. I have a new purpose for you. You're no longer going to be just Simon, but you are going to be Peter." Now, you'll see that a couple ways. You'll see it here in John where they spoke of the Aramaic Cephas or Kephas, but then you'll also see it in Greek as Petros, and it means a giant rock, a large rock. And Jesus said, "Listen, no more you're just going to be a hearer, but you're going to be a rock for the gospel truth." In fact, in Matthew chapter 16, in Matthew's gospel, you may recall there was a time Jesus was walking through a city with the disciples, and he asked them a question, "Who do people say that I am?" Simon jumped up and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of God." And listen to Jesus' response, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of John. You are Peter, and on this rock, I will build my church." Now, many, because of the understanding of what the word Peter and Petros, meaning a large rock, they take that to believe that Jesus was saying, "It's on Peter that I'm going to build my church." In fact, many have considered him the great priest, Peter, because of that statement. But that's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying, "Yes, Peter, you are a rock, but you're a rock because of what you believe about who I am." See, Jesus is saying, "On this rock I will build my church." He's talking about on the confession that Peter gave, that Jesus alone is the Son of God, the Messiah. And it's on that truth, on that rock, that Jesus would build his church. But it was Peter that he would use in incredible ways. And so here we have this Peter who was a rock for the Lord, who said, "I'll never leave you. Jesus, I will die for you." Remember, he said that right before the denials of Christ. It was Peter that was part of the three in the inner circle, James, John, and Peter. It was Peter, this rock who walked on water to be with Jesus. Peter, this rock who was at the transfiguration and saw Jesus in all of his glory. And yet that same Peter was the one who three times denied. Remember, Pansy Peter, even to a little girl by the fire, said, "I don't know who the guy is," right? That same rock crumbled when he was confronted. And what did he do? He returned to fishing. He returned to his old ways. He returned to his old life. Now, Jesus knew of Peter's failures. In fact, he witnessed them firsthand. The Bible tells us that on the third time when Peter said, "I don't know who the man is," the rooster crowed and the eyes of Jesus were directly on Peter. It's in that he literally ran away crying. And here's what's incredible about this. Church, hear this well. Jesus knew. Matter of fact, he foretold Jesus, "Peter, Simon, you're gonna deny me." And he did it. And he looked right at him, and Peter ran away crying. And now here we open this scene with Jesus inviting him to the fire, inviting this Peter who had such failure in his life to come and be with Jesus. Church, can I tell you something? You can't sin beyond Jesus' love for you. You can't out-sin his love. It doesn't matter how big of a mistake you made, how much you blow it, you can't out-sin Jesus' love for you. And man, that's evident in Peter's life, isn't it? Denying him three times, even after he confronted Jesus, that it would never happen. And yet here we see Peter coming out of that water, soaking wet, cold. And Jesus says, come, come by the fire. Come, be with me by my fire and be warmed, be dried. Let me feed you. Let me give you comfort. Let me give you forgiveness. You see that? This is an invitation to Peter to be redeemed. And church, that same invitation is there for us today too. No matter what you've done, maybe you've denied Christ, maybe you've walked away, maybe you've sinned, but you'll never sin too much that Jesus won't be on that shore with a fire lit and food ready to say, come child, come on in, get dry, get warm, be fed. But he starts out verse 15 there. He asks this question. He says, Simon, do you love me more than these? Now, what exactly is he referring to with these? What does that mean? There really are three major camps here, if you will, or beliefs about what the these are, what Jesus is referring to. The first is that Jesus is saying, Simon, do you love me more than the other disciples? That is to say, do you love me more than you love them? Right? Do you love me more than you love them? You've ran away, you've gone to them, and you've fled from me. Simon, do you love me more than you love them? You see, aren't we guilty of that, church, often of putting other relationships before our relationship with Christ? It happens all the time, doesn't it? We allow other people in our lives, other relationships to supersede our relationship with Jesus. So possibly Jesus is asking them just that. In fact, when you think about it, what are the first two commandments that God gives Moses? You shall have no other gods before me, right? You shall not make for yourselves an idol. What's that saying? Don't put anyone in place of me. Don't put any other relationship ahead of your relationship with me, and don't make yourself an idol. You know what we do with that today? We make ourselves the idol, don't we? We are God. I want to determine what's right. I want to determine what's wrong. I'm God. And so, quite possibly, Jesus is asking that question, do you love me more than you love them? Or maybe he's saying, then you love yourself. That, Simon, are you willing to deny Simon, the old you, in order to forsake everything to follow me? Some believe that. Others believe that he's asking this question, do you love me more than the other disciples do? That is, Simon, do you love me more than they love me? I mean, when you think about it, it was Peter was the one who said, hey, I'm going fishing. The other disciples just followed along. So perhaps Jesus is saying, Simon, do you really love me more than them? Because they were staying put. You ran away and you actually encouraged them to come with you. Perhaps. But the third option is this, and this is where I land and what I believe. I believe Jesus was saying, do you love me more than these? Now, remember, it's by the seashore there. At this point, they've rowed the boat ashore. They've pulled the net up. There's 153 fish laying around. And I just have to believe in my spirit that Jesus, standing there by all of this, looks out and says, Simon, do you love me more than these? Do you love me more than these 153 fish? Do you love me more than what you love out of life? Do you love me more than the things that gave you comfort and security before you came to know me? And so really what Jesus is saying, Peter, are you willing to leave all this behind for me? Hey, think about it. That was his greatest, 153 fish in a single catch. Man can make a pretty good career out of that back in the day, right? And Jesus asked him, do you love me more than all this? Are you willing to forsake it all in order to follow me? And church, here's the point. It's really not a salvation issue which of the three you believe. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't at all. In fact, maybe he asked three times, three different questions, because there's a little bit of truth in all three of them. All three are true, pointing to this, that we should love nothing more than Jesus. Regardless, another person, an activity, wherever it is that you find your safety, your serenity, your security, nothing should supersede Jesus. And you can't get away from that here. When you look through the text and you see this number three just being repeated over and over, I mean, there were the three denials of Peter, then the three questions of love from Jesus, then the three confessions of Simon, then the three commissions of Jesus of what he was supposed to do. All this taking place when? At Jesus' third appearance to Peter. Three times for all these, and three times he asked him. But can I tell you something? As I read through it, it makes all the sense in the world if Simon asked Jesus three times, "Do you love me?" Wouldn't it? I mean, think about it. He's made a mess of things. He blew it. He ran away crying. It would make all the sense in the world if Peter was saying, "Jesus, do you really love me?" Doesn't it? You ever been there? You ever had sin and failure in your life, and you're in your prayers, and you think, "Jesus, do you really love me? I mean, Jesus, how could you love me?" That would make all the sense in the world for Peter to be asking the question. But Jesus is asking him, "Peter, do you love me?" Now, a lot of people get hung up here. There's a deep study on this. I'm sure if you've got a study Bible, it's in your notes there. But there are two different words used for love here. And I've said this before, you know, in the English language, we're very simplified, right? We're it's a pretty simple language. And so because of that, we use the word love for everything, right? Like, I love the Lord, I love my wife, I love fried pies, I love a Thomas Rhett concert. Yeah, we all these things, right? We got all kinds of loves in our life, but certainly they have different levels, right? But now, for Koine Greek, they had specific words with specific meanings for each one of them. And here we see that come into play. When Jesus first asked the question, "Simon, do you love me?" He uses the word agapao from agape. "Peter, do you agapao me?" That is perfect love, agape love. It's the same word that Jesus used when he said, "For God," 3:16, "for God so loved the world that he gave his own one and only son." To express God's love for you and I, for this world, this perfect love that only God can have, they use the word agape. It's the purest, it's the highest love. Peter responds. Jesus says, "Simon, do you agapao love me?" Simon responds this way, "Yes, Jesus, I phileo love you." The word phileo is another word for love, but it doesn't mean agape, that perfect love. It really means like a caring or a loyal love. You may, in Pennsylvania, the city Philadelphia, that's where it gets its nickname, the city of brotherly love, is from that phileo, just like Philadelphia, but phileo love. And so Jesus asked Simon, "Man, Peter, do you agape, agapao, love me, perfectly love me?" And Peter responds, "Lord, I love you like a brother." Second time, Jesus asks, "Peter, do you agapao, perfectly love me?" The second time, Simon says, "Jesus, I phileo, I love you like a brother." And the third time, Jesus then stops, steps down and says, "Peter, do you really phileo, love me like a brother?" Peter says, "Jesus, you know all things. You know that I love you like a brother." Why is that important? People get so hung up on this, but here's what's important to understand. First of all, three times Peter had denied Christ. Now, three times Jesus asked him, "Do you love me?" forgiving him of the sins he had committed against him. But what's most important is for us to understand what Jesus is saying. See, he says, "Peter, do you have a perfect love for me?" And don't you love Simon's honesty here? Nope. "Peter, do you agape love me?" "No, but I phileo love you." Right? I mean, in essence, that's what Simon is saying. "Listen, God, I want to love you that way, but you know what I've done. You know how I failed you. You know that I denied you. You know that I ran away and came out here fishing. You know everything about me. I want to give you that perfect love, but I'm falling short." And what's Jesus' response? He receives it, doesn't he? He receives it. You see, Jesus wants perfect love from you. He really does. And that's what he's going to give to you. But he understands your failures. He understands your shortcomings. He understands it is difficult for you to love him as much as he loves you. But he'll still take it. He'll still take it. He goes on to respond, "And if you do love me," even at the phileo level, "if you do love me, then you're going to do what? You're going to have some works to show for it. You're going to feed my sheep. You're going to shepherd my sheep. You're going to feed my lambs." The same as James said, for us not only to be hearers of the word, but what? Also doers. And isn't it interesting that Simon's name, Simon means to be a hearer of the word? Simon, the hearer of the word. And Jesus said, listen, I don't want you to just hear it. I want you to go do something with it. I want you to go feed some sheep. I want you to go shepherd some sheep. I want you to feed some pitiful lambs. Don't just hear the words. Don't just receive my love, but do something with it. Folks, this isn't a solo mission. If you're saved, you're saved for a purpose. Not just because God loves you. He does love you, but he loves everyone else too. And he wants to use you just like he used Peter and the rest of the disciples, what, to share that love with other people. Do you get that? We're not here to play church. We're here on a mission to fulfill the gospel. Northside, to share and to show the good news of Jesus in these walls and outside of these walls. He said, listen, I want you to go and do something because of that love. Verse 21, truly I tell you, when you were younger, you would tie your belt and walk wherever you wanted. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will tie you and carry you where you don't want to go. He said this to indicate by what kind of death Peter would glorify God. After saying this, he told him, follow me. Now, what he's saying here, Jesus was letting Peter know, listen, Peter, you are going to be crucified yourself. You're going to, as a matter of fact, it says you're going to follow me. Jesus said, Peter, you're going to follow me all the way to the cross. Just like you see me crucified, Peter, you are going to walk those same footsteps. You are going to be crucified for my sake also. And then he talks about how when he was younger, he kind of did things his own way, but as he's older, he's going to do them another way. And what he's saying is this, the Simon of old, right, the young Simon, the Simon before he met Peter, man, he would run away from this. He would fight against it. He would run away from martyrdom. But there's a new Simon, the new Peter, the Peter that's going to get some more years behind him, the Peter that after he met Christ, the Peter that after he saw the resurrected Christ, and that Peter is going to embrace it. See, the old Peter, the young Simon, man, he would have run away, but the new Peter that God's created and called him to be, he's going to embrace it. Why? All for God's glory. For God's glory. And I love this because you remember when we talked in the beginning that we said John wrote this gospel some 20 years after the resurrection of Jesus, after the crucifixion of Simon Peter even. And history tells us, not the Bible, but other historical documents that we trust, that when Peter was crucified, they had nailed him to the cross as Jesus said they would. And before they placed it in the ground, Peter had this request, put me upside down. I want to stick that cross upside down in the ground. Why? Because I don't deserve to die like my Savior died. Man, that's a change in a person, isn't it? Not only was he crucified, but he did it upside down because he didn't feel worthy to die like Jesus died. You know, I look at that conversation that Jesus had with Peter, and I think, what if that were me? Like, church, can you imagine? What if you left here today and you went home to pray and you were just in the moment in prayer and you were praying like never before and God began to speak to you in a way you had never heard before. And as you're listening to all that God's telling you, God said, listen, I want you to know you're going to die a horrific death for my glory. How would you respond? And before you do, I want you to think about this. How many of us, when we're praying to God and we're asking for all kinds of stuff, God, I want that relationship. God, I want that job. God, I want that house. God, I want that promotion. God, I want this healing for myself or for this person. And we ask those things, and when God doesn't give us what we want, what do? Well, God's not real. He didn't give me what I wanted. God doesn't care. He didn't give me what I wanted. God must not love me, or God must not hear me. Right? We get that petty when he just doesn't give us the desires of our hearts. What if in your prayer life, God said, you're going to die a miserable death for my glory? Church, how would you respond to that? How would you respond? What would you do? What would your life look like? How would things change for you? I'll tell you what happened to Peter. Peter caught fire for the Lord. After all of this, after all they'd been through, when Jesus finally said, listen, you're going to die just like me, all for God's glory. From that moment on, Peter was on fire for the Lord. And I couldn't help but in my study, as I was thinking about that, I began to think about the fires around Peter. You know, it was at that fire with that little girl where he wimped out. It's, I don't even know who Jesus is, right? It was here in this text. It was at a fire that Jesus welcomed him back and reinstated him. And then after this, some 10 days later, we're going to read in the book of Acts at Pentecost, where it says that tongues of fire came down on Peter. And he preached a message, and more than 3,000 people were saved. You see, Peter, when he got the news that things weren't going to end like he wanted or like he desired, he caught fire for the Lord. And I can't help but wonder if there Peter is. He's nailed to that cross. He's hanging upside down. He's looking at God. He's looking to the heavens, looking between his toes, hanging upside down. Do you think Peter said, Jesus, I agapao you. I fully, completely, perfectly love you. See the turnaround in his life? Verse 21 then, or 20, excuse me. So Peter turned around after all this and saw the disciple Jesus loved following them, the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and asked, Lord, who is the one that's going to betray you? Remember, John doesn't refer to himself in text. I believe out of humility, but he's constantly referencing himself. And once again, here we see him doing that. Peter saw him and said, Lord, what about him? Verse 22, if I want him to remain until I come, Jesus answered, what is that to you? As for you, follow me. So this rumor spread to the brothers and sisters that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not tell them that he wouldn't die. But if I want him to remain until I come, what's that to you? This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. And there are so many other things that Jesus did, which if every one of them were written down, I suppose not even the world itself could contain the books that would be written. Look at verse 22 here. Peter immediately, after going through all of this, man, he's sinned, he's failed, he's gone fishing, he's given up on the faith, on his calling. Jesus calls him, he dives in the water, he warms by the fire, Jesus feeds him. Right? He reinstates him and he says, Peter, Simon, you are going to glorify God through your death. And Peter says, I'm all in. Let's do it. Verse 20. But what about him? Right? And can you believe Peter asked this question? Right? I mean, look, he's saying, if I got to die, let's do it, baby. I'm all in. Let's go. Right? I'm there. But I don't need to be alone. I mean, we got, you know, there's 11 of us here. Right? He's like, what about him? What about John? What's going to happen to him, right? And we read that and we think, oh my gosh, Peter. Like, only Peter would say that, right? Even though everybody else would be thinking it, only Peter would voice it out. But he does. I mean, he was a work in progress still. We look at that and we just want to nail Peter, don't we? It's like, what a bozo, you know? But then we do that too, don't we? I dare say there's not a person in this room, if you've been a believer very long at all, that you've not at some point in your life asked that same question. What about them? Right? Well, why do some Christians go through hardships and not others? Well, why do some people who are serving the Lord and giving themselves to God so faithfully, why do they have tragedy in their life? And then other people who don't acknowledge God at all, man, they just seem to go through life perfectly well, no issues. You ever been there? You're probably lying if you say no. Right? We do it all the time. Well, what about them? Well, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Well, why, you know, it's a big church. We got 1,000 people here. Oh, why am I going through this and the person beside me isn't? Right? You ever been there? You ever wondered when you're going through hardships, why you and not someone else? Hey, I've been on the other side too to say, man, why is that happening to him and not me? That would make sense. We do the same thing. Why does this happen to others? Or we look to other people and their faith, and we get so concerned about how someone else lives out their faith. Well, they don't believe right. Well, they don't do right. Well, they don't act right. You know what Jesus says here? Man, just focus on you. What does he say? You follow me. Don't you worry about John. Don't you worry about Thomas. Don't you worry about Thaddeus. Don't you worry about Bartholomew. Simon Peter, you just need to worry about Simon Peter. That's it. See, folks, I want to tell you something. The compare game will kill you in your walk with the Lord. It really will. When you start comparing yourself or your situation to other people, it will absolutely destroy you. Why? Because you'll either think too highly of yourself or too lowly of yourself, right? You'll go find somebody, they're jacked up, and you're like, well, gosh, compared to them, I'm pretty good. You know, I'm all right. You know, I don't feel so bad about myself now that I've met them, right? Not that that would happen here, but, you know, we may think too highly of ourselves. Or often, you'll see other people, and you'll question your own faith. So, my gosh, look at them. Man, it's like they're walking on water for Jesus. They're doing so much more for him than I'm doing. Then I must not have a rap on this. I must not really be saved. You'll think too lowly of yourself. Do you know, for pastors, this is one of the most difficult issues we face. It really is. The comparison game, oh my goodness, guys, it's awful. It's awful for this guy. I get it from everywhere. Hey, you know what so-and-so's preacher did? You know what he talked, you know what they did? You know what that church is doing? You know how many they baptized? You know how many books he wrote? This one's got more degrees than a thermometer. You know what I mean? It's like all the comparison. What's that preacher doing, right? And hey, I do it too. I do. I look at others and I think, man, I need to do more. I need to be more. Why? Maybe I need to step aside. Look at the success that preacher's having. Did you know, because of this very thing, I almost gave up on ministry? I don't know if I've shared this before, but not too many years ago. That's the truth. I remember I was studying a handful, really three pastors that were just incredibly successful. Well-known, as a matter of fact, everyone in this room would likely know all three of their names. They were in explosive churches, baptizing people by the multiple hundreds every year, multi-site campuses. They were just, writing books, doing incredible preaching all over the world, doing incredible things for the Lord. And so I wanted to learn more about them and begin to study them. And I wanted to understand, hey, what are they doing? Like, well, what's their prayer life like and their study life? And what is their weekly activities like? I wanted to learn from them. I'm going to tell you, I started reading some of their memoirs, some of their books they put out and blogs and all these posts, and it tore me to pieces. This is what I found out. Those guys were saying, I pray 8 hours a day. One guy said he wakes up at 3:00 in the morning, face down on the ground for hours every day. I thought, my land, what a loser am I? I'm serious. Listen, your pastor prays. You need to know that and believe that, but compared to these guys, I mean, they were hours upon hours. I thought, my goodness. And so I tried to pray more and pray more. And then I started learning about how they would prepare their messages. Well, what did they do? You know, several of them said just minutes a day. Minutes a day. I thought, am I that stupid? That's a bad word. Am I that ignorant, right? Minutes a day. I'm hours and hours, and ask my family, hours in study and preparation. I thought, my goodness. And I started doing this compare game, and I thought, I can't do that. I'm failing. I'm not praying near as much as they are. I'm studying twice as much as they are. They're far better preachers than I am. This must not be my calling. Or, man, Northside deserves better than me. And I literally almost got to a place where I thought, yeah, I've got to walk away. I want to fast forward a few years. Three men that I was studying, three men that I was comparing myself to, three men that almost caused me to walk away from the faith. One lost his ministry and his wife to alcoholism just in the last few years. The other lost his church, and they closed all the additional campuses associated with that church. Why? Because of deceit, lying, and abuse of power. And I almost quit over those jokers. And yet I read their stuff, and I thought, man, they're doing so much more. And now I question, were they really doing that, or were they lying about that too? Were they really praying 8 hours a day, or was it maybe an hour, you know? And yet, because I was comparing to what they said, I was ready to walk away. Then I find out these jokers, man, they've got people on staff that do all their research for them. They have paid research assistants. No wonder they're only studying minutes a day, right? And I was going to, I didn't know that, right? They're preaching three times a month at best, right? I was going to quit over that. That's what the comparison game will do to you. Folks, I had to come to a place where I just said, hang them all. That's it. I ain't comparing anymore. I'm just going to be me, and you guys are stuck with it, and I'm sorry. But the truth is this. What are y'all laughing over that for? I thought I'd get... That's where you say, no, David, you're good. Okay, you know, that's not right. No, I'm just teasing. But it's the truth. I'm just going to be me. And truth is, I'm not even doing a great job at that. I'm doing my best, and I'm failing miserably at it. That's no excuse to be lazy in the pulpit, to not be in prayer, to not study. That's no excuse to say, well, I'm just going to be me. No, I want to be all that God has called me to be. And he told Simon Peter, he said, you worry about you. Don't you worry about what everybody else is doing. Don't worry about what's happening to them. Don't worry about how good they've got it or how bad they've got it. Just be thankful for what you have. You know, you look at this, and isn't it interesting? It was Peter, Simon Peter, it was his failure and his redemption that God used. It really was. Not his perfectionism. Not his knowledge, not his wisdom, not his exceptional leadership skills. This was an uneducated fisherman who failed miserably and God used extraordinarily. Amen? God used his failures. Why? Because that's what God does. God uses those who understand his grace best. Do you understand that? In Luke chapter 7, in Luke's gospel, he shares a story. Oh, my. He shares a story of a time when Jesus was invited to a Pharisee's house to have dinner, and he's there, and they're eating, they're reclined at the table, and a prostitute comes in. What? Yeah, a prostitute comes in, falls at the feet of Jesus. Obviously, she had been heard him speak at one point and been forgiven of her sins, and she comes in, and she's crying and slobbering and snotting all over his feet and taking her hair and wiping it off and pouring perfume on. And here's the response they give in verse 39 of chapter 7. When the Pharisee who had invited him in saw this, he said to himself, this man, if he were a prophet, would know what kind of woman is touching him. She's a sinner. Jesus replied to him. Now let me say this. Remember, he was talking to himself. He didn't say that out loud. But Jesus knew what was on his heart. He knew what was on his mind. Jesus responded to what this man was thinking. Simon, now not Simon Peter, this is Simon the Pharisee. Simon, I have something to say to you. He said, say it, teacher. A creditor had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. Since they could not pay it back, he graciously forgave them both. So which one will love him more? Simon answered, I suppose the one who was forgiven more. You have judged correctly, he told him. What's he saying? The more grace you receive, the more you know about Jesus. And the more you love Jesus. And the more you should be willing to go and forgive others and share that same love with them. See, when you receive that from Jesus, when you have a relationship with him, when you have seen your failures like Peter did, but you've come to that campfire invitation and Jesus has forgiven you of your sins, folks, you're not only redeemed, but you're reinvigorated. Man, you want to go out and tell everybody about that kind of love. And John then, he takes the opportunity in verse 23 to kind of squash. There was a lot of rumors going around. Remember, he wrote this years later, and I love that because he's telling exactly what happened with Jesus, but he's interjecting what had taken place since that time too. He said, they were all messed up. They thought I was going to live forever. That didn't happen at all. And then he closes out in verses 24 and 25, and you may remember we began our study there also, kind of booking ending now as we close. John paints this portrait and he gives a perspective. And he closes out this way. He said, listen, Jesus has done so much. Man, he did so much. If I were to write it down, the world couldn't hold it. He says, I can't even scratch the surface. 16 weeks we've been in the study of John. 16 weeks, I hope you've been reading along. And folks, can I tell you something? We barely scratched the surface of the book of John. John says, man, I lived with him for 3 years and I'm writing this down, and I got to tell you, with all of this, it's barely scratching the surface of all that he did. So here's our final question. Have you acknowledged all that Jesus has done for you? For you. Have you acknowledged that? This was Peter's invitation to come back to Christ. Maybe for some of you, That's your invitation too. You know that you've walked away. You've not been living for the Lord, and this is your time. He's calling you back. Northside, we've spent 16 weeks reading and studying the book of John. And what was his ultimate goal? Was to paint a picture of who Jesus is for us. And I pray that through this study, you see Jesus in a new light of love and sacrifice, all for you. All for you. But what's your commitment to him? What's your commitment to him? Have you given your life to Christ? Is there sin in your life that you need to ask forgiveness? Have you received that eternal gift that he has for you? Have you made that public through baptism? Where are you at? You know what he's done for you. Church, what's he calling you to do for him?